This is a WMNF public service announcement. Job Site Theater presents Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet in the Strass Center's Jabe Theater from January 12th through February 6th. Set against an original 80s-inspired score by Jeremy Douglas and directed by David Jenkins, Job Site draws the Bard's timeless tales into a modern context. Weekday matinee field trip performances available for school groups. More at jobsitetheater.org.
Welcome to Sustainable Living with Mary Glennie and Arlene Engelhart here on WMNF Tampa. I'm going to turn this on over to Mary right now.
Well, hi. You are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio, and I am really excited about this program, excited that this is Martin Luther King Day, and that, you know, it's about service. And the two guests we have in this program have been serving the environment and so many other issues for so long that I'm so thrilled to be talking with them on the show today. Our first guest is going to be Elizabeth Arroyte, and she's an American science, nature writer extraordinaire, really. Her writing is just so profound, so in-depth, you will learn so much, that she's best known for her books, Garbage Land, The Tapir's Mourning, Bottle Mania, and these books went on sale, and they are very popular, but she's also written for the New York Times, the National Geographic, the Atlantic, Harper's, and so The Nation. And so without further ado, well, I want to welcome to the show Elizabeth Arroyte. Hello, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Mary. Hi, Mary.
Bill, I can't hear her. I can't hear.
Hello? Can you hear me?
I'll come over there.
Yeah, she's going to be right with you there.
It does help if I plug in my earphones. Okay. Well, Elizabeth, to talk with you, honestly, there are so many subjects I want to cover. But I guess the one I will start with, because I think it is so ubiquitous and such an extraordinary problem, I don't know how we're really going to solve it. I'm hoping the ocean has some solutions that can give us some clues. But plastics. And I think I read about something about the 9 billion tons we have created, that 90% of it's never been recycled, and it keeps breaking down to these smaller and smaller particles. And so every organism in the sea is eating the plastics, as are we, and we're breathing it. I swear climate change won't do us in. Plastic is going to do it first. And so what do you think?
It's a huge problem. I'm not up on the latest numbers, but the more we look, the more places we look, the more places we find plastics. They are breaking down into these microplastics, and then they weather down into tinier pieces called nanoparticles, which are extremely difficult to find and to track and to remove. And we can work on beach cleanups and things like that, but I really think that the answer is to turn off the tap and not be mopping up. And all of us need to use a lot fewer plastics and look at alternatives to petroleum-based materials.
Yeah, and I'm going to tie this into your bottle mania, because I was absolutely fascinated reading about it. I mean, I don't know when tap water became so dangerous. I mean, I know we have some problems with lead in the pipes and some situations that need to be addressed, but we need to address them. In other words, the solution is not to start drinking bottled water. And I thought it was fascinating that you and your colleague Bill McGibbon were saying that really it represents a lack of handling with the problem, and that everybody can just carry around their bottle of water and we can swig endlessly. And so would you talk about that? Because I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, I think I used this term in my book, Bottle Mania, How Water Went on Sale and Why We Bought It, which is many years old by now. But I use this word hyper-individualization, and was looking at this movement from collective responses to sharing. You know, we used to listen to music out loud and in public, and now we all have earbuds. We used to use public telephones, and now we have our own phones. We used to drink water from cups or from water fountains, and now everyone has their own private, individual, hygienically sealed bottle of water. So again, it's sort of talking about turning off the tap of plastics. Let's turn on the public tap and pay attention to the quality of our water and watershed protection. And just say, no, I've got mine. You know, I'm going to buy my water. I don't have to worry about what my neighbors are drinking. And we need to take care of the problem at the root and protect our water and fix our pipes and know what's going on, where our water comes from and what's going on in the pipes in our homes, and work on those so that everyone can have access to clean, safe, affordable water.
Yeah, and I think it really kind of underscores, I think, a terrible problem we have right now. Namely, we seem to be on a hyper-pursuit of individualism. And I'm not quite sure, or maybe part of the reason is that I'm going to tie this into another book you wrote about the tapirs and mourning ritual in the rainforest.
Wait, number one, it's a taper, and it's the taper's mourning bath.
Oh, right.
Mysteries of the tropical rainforest.
Well, and we know that they are the lungs of the earth. I mean, we're with the oceans, absorbing the carbon dioxide, et cetera, but also freeing the oxygen. But would you talk about that a little bit? Because I was just absolutely fascinated. Did you go down to the rainforest, and did you observe them? And give us a little summary of that, because it's absolutely appalling, a lot of it illegally, but the way that the rainforests are being forested. And this is very dangerous. And so could you talk about that?
Sure. So that was the first book I wrote, and I wasn't at that point a writer who followed waste streams. It was my second book, Garbage Land, that I got diverted into writing about waste and consumption issues. So the first book is about, I went to live at a biological research station on an island in the Panama Canal, and it's the longest running tropical rainforest station on the planet. And I went there because I had followed Edward O. Wilson, the biologist who died last month. I did a piece for the New York Times Magazine on Ed Wilson, and he had never been to this research station, and it was my first time in a rainforest, and I was just fascinated by the work that the researchers did there. And Ed Wilson was the consummate guide to the forest, so I really... it was a great introduction. And I had been writing magazine stories for a long time, and I wanted to write a book, and I knew this place was worth a lot more scrutiny, so I moved there for a year. And I wrote about why people study the tropics and do organismal biology, and why people study biodiversity even as it's disappearing so quickly. And so it really didn't focus a lot on large swaths of rainforest. I mean, I touch on the importance of them, of course, and the importance of studying them, but I was really focusing on a community of scientists and how science gets done and why basic research matters.
Well, you know, I'm so glad you said that, because I found reading so many of your articles that you really have an extraordinary mind. And when you really, well, but I mean, I really find that it's not only interest, but it's a way of attacking a problem. And I find really good writers, really good thinkers, that just if you follow their process, you will learn a lot about when you see problems, how to approach it. And so I was really fascinated, because I found that you take that approach to so many problems. And you combine, like, I was fascinated at the amount of people that don't have any access, you know, to sewage and toilets, et cetera, and that have to defecate in the open, so to speak, or waterways so commonly. And we realize just what a terrible, you know, risk that is to everything, you know. And it is that kind of combinations that you make. And so I'm really curious right now, because I hardly know where to begin, whether it's all the chemicals in our environments, which relate to the plastics, because the same people that are giving us all the drins, so to speak, the Aldrins and all of these drins, are also the ones that gave us plastics. And, you know, that where are you really focusing right now with the most severe problems we have?
Wow. So I hardly know where to begin either. And I don't really have a program. It's not like I plan out, you know, years in advance what I'm going to be working on. I have my interests. And after writing that first book about the rainforest and the scientists who work there, I did sort of pivot to these consumption and waste issues and started thinking about where things go downstream from us, but you cannot consider where things go downstream without looking upstream to where they come from. So I've sort of used that to write about so many different issues. I'm looking a lot at agriculture now and where our waste intersects. I mean, everything intersects. You know, everything has to go somewhere. That's a basic tenet of ecology. And everything is connected. So my scope is pretty large, and it's not as if I have a program of attack here. You know, I'm working out, so it's what comes to me, what I feel like writing about at the moment, and what someone will publish.
And, you know, I'm thinking of many things, industrial agriculture. And just on a personal note, I happen to come from a small area in Illinois, some of the richest farmland actually in the country. And my grandparents, my great-grandparents farmed there and did very well. All the people there, it was very rich land, and they learned a lot about farming. And the progression there that has happened, very shortly, I remember when I was in college, Arthur Daniel Midland's bought all of that land. And so here you have some of the richest soil in Illinois, and instead of using that soil and following, you know, kind of the farming step on a larger scale, they started to contour the land to fit their machinery. Uh-huh. And so then after they really depleted it pretty fast and they totally screwed the water levels and the way it drained, et cetera, that they actually sold that land, I believe, to Shell. And now they're fracking for natural gas. And so they have found that the sand in that area is so good. It's so much better. They have trouble finding just the right sand for fracking because beach sand.
Oh, they're mining it. Mining it for sand. They're fracking it for sand. Yeah.
So now they're fracking it for sand. And just in my lifetime, I have seen that kind of a total disregard for land and soil and sustainability. And I'm just kind of horrified.
Yeah, all just short-term gain and, right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that, you know, it used to be, again, I'm going back to my farm roots, so to speak, that every single farmer had a section of their property that was forest, that was, you know, natural. And people really enjoyed that. I noticed that they would have their own burial plots there, and they would be in that land because that was kind of special. And they, many times you'd have weddings there. I mean, really, it was kind of a gathering place. And I think that that is missing from us now. And so we have all this industrial agriculture, which is just pouring chemicals, you know, because it has to be totally sustained that way. And a lot of those chemicals not only are not good for us, get in our water, get in the soil, but they also destroy most of the birds and the animals that used to be there. And I think there is this lack of connection and any sense that, you know, that in order to survive, you have to be sustainable. In other words, when you're surviving, you're surviving for the seventh generation down the line. And that seems to be totally lost.
I totally agree with you. And I do think I think awareness is growing because these compounds are coming around to bite us. Uh-huh. And people are looking more closely. It's a really expensive to look for things, and so people don't want to look for things because if they find things, they might be forced to do something about it. So that's a problem with a lot of our drinking water standards and now soil. But there's a lot of concern with these PFOAs, PFAS chemicals from non-stick compounds, stain-proof clothing, textiles. So people are starting to look at how they end up on farm fields when people are spreading sewage sludge. You know, our waste leaves our homes, mixes with stormwater, snow melt, goes to treatment plants. Liquids are separated from solids. Liquids go back into waterways. Where do the solids go? That's a big problem in this country. We're not allowed to dump them in oceans and big rivers anymore. So there's a lot of land application of sludge, and now we're finding that a lot of PCCPs, pharmaceuticals, personal care products, and these compounds from plastics and the nonstick chemicals are showing up in sludge. And the big question is, where do they go next? Are they going into foods that we eat or that animals eat, and then we eat the animals? And people are finding that, yes, in many cases they are. So that's something that I'm looking into a bit now.
And you named a product, and is that part of our anti-wrinkle mania, which I have noticed is one of the latest things? You know, you've not only got to smell beautiful, and I think of all those nanoparticles which you're absorbing in your bloodstream, and God knows what it's going to do to you, but it's not going to be good. But now you can't be wrinkled. I mean, it's individualism that is actually getting absurd. And maybe that, you know, it's kind of Nero, you know, fiddling away while Rome was burning. We have a country and we have a climate and a world that desperately needs everything. Or maybe we should just step aside. Maybe it's good that we're fiddling away at nothing, because I think nature has possibilities that we wouldn't even imagine possible. And I
maybe
have.
Maybe we are being swept aside, you know, if you look at our cancer rates. And are you talking about this wrinkle? Are you talking about dryer sheets?
You know, I don't know what. No, not the dryer sheets. It's something you put in, and there's some of them are crystals, some of them are fluids, and you put them in, I imagine, somewhere in your rinse cycle, you know, of doing your clothes.
Oh, God.
And they come off with this beautiful scent, which I find so. My eyes will burn terribly if I'm around people that have it. And really, you know, people that use it, because when you walk by them, you know, they're just a flower garden. And its only problem is that you'll start to sneeze and your eyes will burn.
Right. There are scientists studying this phenomenon of urban pollution and all the products that we put on ourselves, and they give off, I can't remember the name of the particles that hold on to smells, but yeah, they're finding more of them in cities, and they can follow people's plumes as they walk down the street. It's an interesting area of study. Not sure what it's doing to us, but.
Okay, and so I really do want to get into what you consider the most urgent problems right now that you're following.
Well, I think climate change.
Yeah. Arlene, just one sec. Arlene's trying to tell me something.
Oh, I was trying to just let listeners know, we know that one listener found the station during Dr. Harvey's program.
Oh, good.
And we hope that there may be others that are finding us today. This is WMNF Tampa. You can find us online at WMNF.org. You can listen to us on the radio at 88.5. And so we hope you'll join us. As far as I know, this is the only sustainable living program in the southeastern U.S., and I certainly would like to see more, and we need more writers like you. That's one of the reasons I think that people are becoming more aware. They are finding they have problems with some of these things, and then they begin to look around, and they find a writer like you. So you are very important in this whole chain.
And her name is Elizabeth Royte,
right?
And she writes in National Geographic, The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine. You will find her, and also The Nation. I think, in fact, you started with The Nation, I think.
You've done your research, yeah.
Well, actually, I was exposed to you quite a while ago because I also, on this show, was following what was happening to the women in Rwanda. And so you have been on my radar for a long time, and you will find that Elizabeth is an extraordinary writer. She really does her research, but she's thinking through the whole process, and so you, I think, will come out thinking a little differently, and to me that's extremely valuable. And so climate change, tell me, Elizabeth, I really do believe in nature's ability to handle a lot of problems. And I've been impressed, you know, with everything from, you know, the tidal waves. I don't totally understand it, but I think it's fascinating that that can give us energy, et cetera. In other words, there are so many ways that we can get ourselves off of fossil fuels. And so what are some of the areas that you find most interesting and you're really watching?
I'm interested in what states are doing in the absence of federal leadership to electrify and to build utility-scale wind and solar. I'm interested in offshore wind and tidal power, of course. It's not happening fast enough, and there's a lot of NIMBYism, and I think people have to face up to the fact that there is a huge amount of potential, and we're going to have to compromise on how we want things to look, where we want these things placed, because we need to do a lot of this quickly, and there's just so much pushback to it. And I guess this is easy for me to say because I live in a place where they're not going to put 100, 200 acres of solar panels. No one's going to put a wind turbine near me. So it's easy for me to say, oh, just, you know, get over yourself. But I'm interested in the social engineering that has to go on to push these things forward.
And if we really start to get into this, I can't believe that there won't be a lot of creative, imaginative people that will get involved, and I would imagine they'll get much smaller wind turbines, or maybe they'll be able to do it with even out those arms.
Or fewer and bigger, fewer and larger. That's where offshore wind comes in. They're farther away from people. They can be much bigger. It's hard to erect enormous turbines in a it's hard to deliver the parts on, like, winding roads and, you know, put them on mountaintops. But, yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity to make them more aesthetically pleasing. I mean, I'm looking out my window now at people in their brownstones, and they have these hideous solar panels on their roof. So I'm so glad that they have them, and I thought it looked a lot better without them. But I'd rather see them getting off of their oil and gas furnaces and using solar power. So.
And tell me, the desertization, in other words, water is becoming so critical in every way. And, you know, our body is 70% water. We're a planet of water. And the disregard of the potability of water, and again, I'm looking at something like natural gas, and I think the biggest problem I have with natural gas is how it destroys, so to speak, water, that it so poisons it that we have to isolate it, and it's not that we can't use it anymore. And to me, that should eliminate anything being used, because we've got all the water we're going to get. And to me, this is so serious, and how do you think we address this?
Wait, are you talking about fracking and what fracking does?
Well, not just fracking, but I think our disregard for water, yeah, as if it's somehow an inexhaustible resource. When we have all the water, we're going to get.
People might feel that way. We're not so water limited in the East. We might have problems with too much water as climate change, the grip grows tighter. But out West, people are really reckoning with shortages and the fact that agriculture uses more than 75% of our fresh water. And I think this comes back to what we're growing and what we're eating and our, you know, our meat-centric diets and using a lot of water to grow foods that maybe we shouldn't be eating so much of. I mean, we all need to eat. I don't want to begrudge, you know, farmers need water. You can't grow food without water, but, we need to prioritize, and I think that cities have done a pretty good job of using less water, but there's also water, it's not just quantity, it's quality, and yeah, we need to enforce our Clean Water Act and expand it to protect our watersheds and improve our infrastructure.
Well, I am looking at the time, and Elizabeth, we have run out of time. And I really want to, again, encourage listeners to go to your writing, because you are an extraordinary writer. And that's where I first came in contact with you, obviously. The Atlantic, the New York Times, the National Geographic, Harper's, you'll find it. And so thank you so much. I really appreciated talking to you, and you do take care, particularly on this Martin Luther King Day.
Thank you so much, Mary. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. And so, let's put on just a little music, Bill, or do we have an announcement to make? And then we'll come back. Okay, then, a little music, and then we'll come back with Cynthia Barnett.
Secret lies. I'm not cute, built to suit. fashion model size. But when I start to tell them, they think I'm telling lies. Oh, it's in the reach of my arms, the span of my hips, the stride in my steps, the curl of my lips. I'm a woman. For now I'm in no woman. Oh, I'm a woman. Oh, baby, that's me. I walk into a room just as cool as and they fall down on their knees. Then they swarm around me like a hive of honeybees. Oh, I see it's in the fire in my eyes, the flash of my teeth, the swing of my waist, the joy.
Okay, we are so excited to have our next guest. I'm lucky enough that during the years I've been doing this show, Arlene and I, we've had this woman many times. And Arlene, why don't you read her bio?
Yes, well, Cynthia Barnett is the environmental journalist in residence at the University of Florida. She wrote three books previous to the one that they'll be talking about today, and that book is The Sound of the Sea, Seashells and the Fate of the Oceans. Cynthia came into the station for her first interview with Mary here on her book Rain. I think that was about 5 or 6 years ago. And it was really an exciting interview. We had a lot of response to it. Listeners really liked it. And I think that they are going to find this book equally interesting. And so we'll learn a little more about taking care of each other and our world from the standpoint of seashells.
Cynthia, I have so looked forward to this interview because I found your book on Rain. It told me so much about the water, particularly everything about it here in Florida, both in the rivers, the springs, but also, you know, what's happening with the interaction with the ocean, the Gulf, et cetera. To me, it should be reading that everybody does to understand it. But the seashells.
Thank you. Thank you so much. First, let me say how excited I am to be on the show. Again, we had such a memorable talk about Rain and all of its cultural and scientific iterations. It was a great program, and WMNF is my favorite community radio station. I'm always tuned in, so I really appreciate being with you again. It's so much fun to talk with you, and I'm looking forward to talking about this book.
Well, The Sound of the Sea, you know, to start with, you know, here we are surrounded by water of all kinds. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, and many times I've been over at the Gulf, or when I used to be over in Fort Lauderdale, I'd go up all by the ocean. And it's not only the tides and the surf coming in, you know, which is very impressive. But then when the water is going out, you have this tinkle, almost like fairy tinkles, you know, the shells. And then you dance in the sea what's come ashore. And I thought it was fascinating that you chose to say the sound of the sea. And tell me, why did you choose that title?
So I chose that title really for the metaphor of listening. I love what you've said about the tinkling, and we should talk about the tangible sound a little bit, right? Because we do think of seashells and the marine mollusks that make them as these silent animals, but I'm very moved by, you know, kind of the song of seashells along a shore. And when I describe Sanibel Island, I talk about it as the ocean's softest song, right? It's this wonderful, sparkly tinkle that rises up when you hear those tiny seashells roiling. And like you said, they kind of ring like fairy dust notes. Or, you know, Mary, it also reminds me of rain. The sound of rain in Florida is often a glorious sound that reminds me of applause. And I feel the same way about the smallest shells on the beach. But going back to the title is all about the metaphor of listening, right? So listening to nature, listening to science, listening to indigenous people, listening to women who were unheard in science in previous centuries, and so many others who have sort of been unheard. So I love that idea that we always wanted to pick up seashells and try to listen for the ocean's roar, but really they are helping us listen in other ways, right? So they have a lot to say about what's happening to the oceans and climate change. And so those parts are the serious parts of the book, but I hope to help get readers there with the wonder and the glory of these extraordinary works of art made by marine mollusks.
You know, you have said so much, and you're absolutely right. It's a magic sound, and you know that I heard the old tale. You know, you pick it up, you know, the conch, and you put it to your ear, and you hear, you know, the sea. You're hearing the fluid of your semicircular canals. You're hearing what's in your eardrum, so to speak. But really, you're hearing what's in your brain. And I think that reading this book, and to me, this is a book I'm going to read many times because I've read it a couple times, and there is so much in it. It doesn't really surprise me that you said that there are so many women. You know, I'm thinking of Rachel Carson. I'm thinking of, you know, Anne Lindbergh, Anne Morrill. I'm thinking of so many, you know, great writers, women. Who some of them are known, but not nearly as well known as they should be. And certainly many of the women in this book, I was not familiar with them before I read this book. But to me, it makes a lot of sense that women are particularly interested and appreciate not just the history that these seashells show us, but something about life that I was blown away when in this book I read that 850 million years ago, the first organism in the sea had the smarts to figure out what it needed from that water around it to make an exoskeleton, because that would give it a lot of advantages. And so it was able to extract those minerals and make an exoskeleton. And you might say, in terms of our understanding life, that's where it began.
Yes, yes. So we're both saying a lot. So let me first go to that sound you were talking about. You know, we've always held up shells to our ears to see if they echo the ocean, and that's sort of what we thought. And that's not the case. They really are just they're sort of the perfect resonating chamber to echo the sound of whatever's going on around you. So that's why you hear, you know, a bit of a roar when there's any ambient noise going on at all. And that's what you're hearing in the seashell, like a big conch that you pick up. So the tangible story is really interesting, and then this metaphoric story is interesting. So you talked about this time. Well, first of all, I should back up and say I wanted to start with mollusks and the evolution of mollusks. How did they evolve to build shells? But when I went back the half a billion years to the earliest mollusks, I learned that there were beings before them building shells closer to a billion years ago. So as you note, I start with those earlier creatures that figured out these are you know, micro algae or other microscopic creatures, basically trying to figure out how to not get eaten. And so, as you say, they're pulling in minerals from the surrounding sea, and this is how the first beings and then later marine mollusks evolved to build shells. And I love the story of the earliest shell builders, Mary, because that turned out to be a woman paleobiologist who, she found the first evidence of shells, of animals that made shells, but then she died of cancer before she knew what she found. And then this other young woman paleobiologist came behind her and figured out what these structures were. The earlier scientist, Carol Allison, had suspected what they were. The second generation confirmed what they were. And I love some of those stories of science that come through in the book. But so the bottom line is that, yes, women are very involved in this story, not just surrounding, you know, the beauty of seashells or the teaching of the animal world, as some other women I write about in the book are doing, but also, you know, a lot of the science, and as you mentioned, many of the writers. So Rachel Carson is the one who comes to mind. I think the woman you may not have known, who you're saying you're grateful to know now, and with someone I'm very grateful to know now as well, is Julia Ellen Rogers. She was sort of a hidden figure. She wasn't hidden at the time. At the time, she was one of the most popular nature writers of the turn to the 20th century. And over time, sadly, her work has been forgotten. And in fact, I found her work plagiarized by a quite famous male nature writer whose name most of us know if we're a certain age. And so I was so happy as part of this work, you know, an important part of this work was to remind people seashells are made by these living animals. We always thought more about the seashells than the hidden lives inside. But at another level, I also wanted to bring out, you know, women and others in history who had also been kind of hidden. And that too is a metaphor. So we look at seashells for the beautiful exterior rather than the life inside. And I think that is the same way we have viewed the ocean. We view the ocean as this beautiful postcard or backdrop of life rather than the very source of life. So I hope that readers can engage with this book many different levels, whether it is just being in love with seashells or wanting to understand the story of women in science, or that deeper dive into what climate change and other human impacts are doing to the sea.
And Cynthia, I couldn't agree with you more. And to me, what I was so fascinated is that, you know, the intuitive sense of going back to origins, you know, with the seashells, that what the living organisms will tell you about life in the ocean and how incredibly important that is. And so many times it is the intuition of women. And I'm thinking of a comparison almost that so many of the brilliant astrophysicists we have right now are also women. And to me, no, I'm serious. Yes. And it is beginnings. But when you're going back to beginnings, like, it was so brilliant when you were saying that, you know, she realized that there was a mother lode. Well, now, most people would never think that. I know when I read that, I thought, well, that's brilliant that she just intuited that, you know, there would be a mother lode. And yeah, and she figured out where it would be. I mean, that really is something. And then, unfortunately, she died before she could realize it. But then another woman, years later, picked up on it. Well, now, to me, that is really just extraordinary, but it also is the origins. And then when you go back and you realize, you know, that there have been such totally different environments that, you know, not only were these little organisms, you know, trying to survive, but think of what they did for the entire planet. I mean, and how they changed the composition of the air, you know, with either methane or oxygen or nitrogen. And so you have five different huge areas of evolution. You know, we all think, wow, you know, the asteroid hits and we lose the dinosaurs, and that was kind of it. But it is that kind of continuum, which I just, it kind of blew my mind.
Yes, I love that continuum too. And the other thing about the history of science is that narratives are often written from the point of view of the lone genius, like there is a linear breakthrough. It might be Darwin. In the case of some of the early geology, the lone genius is often Charles Lyell. He is the father of modern geology. And when he's written about, it's often in a one-man show. And one another piece that I appreciated about what I learned about Lyell's work, for one, he was married to a woman. Mary Elizabeth Lyell was a taxonomist in her own right. So when they were traveling together around Europe and the United States, she would often help him identify fossil seashells and other types of fossils. Another fascinating story that comes out of Lyell's science is that when he and his wife would travel around the American Southeast, they would go around to plantations looking for fossil seashell and other fossils that had been found beneath the soil, because some really fascinating seashell fossils had popped up in the American Southeast, far from the ocean. So he is trying to learn about all these creatures, and he would go around to these huge plantations, and he would start plantation managers asking them what they found when they dig into the soil. But the plantation managers didn't know, because they were not the ones digging the wells and digging in the field. So Lyell would inevitably look for an enslaved person who had been digging in the soil. And that person, he said, he could usually give me a clear account of the layers of sand, clay, and limestone they had passed through, and of the fish's teeth they had found, some of which they had preserved. And he said, enslaved people were very inquisitive to know my opinion as to the manner in which marine shells, sharks, teeth, sea urchins, and corals could have been buried in the earth so far from the sea and at such a height. The deluge had occurred to them as a cause, but they were not satisfied with it, observing that they procured these remains not merely near the surface, but from the bottom of deep wells. So in other words, he's gathering all of this intelligence about fossils, and in some cases collecting specimens from enslaved people in the southeastern United States who are, you know, offering a great deal of wisdom about their findings. The same is happening with his wife. The same is happening with Mary Annan, a well-known fossil seller along the Jurassic coast who made many scientific discoveries and wasn't credited in her day. So it's really, science is really never the story of a lone genius. The real story of science, it is often a really winding path with all of these people contributing. So I just loved that piece of this. You know, being able to wind through the story of seashells and credit people who had gone uncredited in the past.
And again, we're talking to Cynthia Barnett. The book we're talking about is The Sound of the Sea. And talk about brilliance, Cynthia. It's the brilliance of the organisms. I mean the you know, their adaptability, their pursuit,
yes,
their and just, you know, just the fascination of the designs of their various exoskeletons that they would develop. It's amazing. So I do want to give some of the skills so some of the discussion, because they are absolutely fascinating. And, you know, I don't know quite where to start, whether I should start with the cowrie or the conch, you know, or the giant, you know, obviously everyone loves that. But shall we start with the little cowrie and how important it was? I'm thinking also of the slaves and how much they knew about seashells.
Yeah, so, well, I guess we could start with what shells are and the protection they provide. So essentially, marine shells are built by mollusks to protect themselves from predators. So as they changed, as they evolved over hundreds of millions of years, marine mollusks evolved all these very clever ways of keeping their predators at bay. So many of the things we really love about seashells, like in the case of the cowrie, it might be that wonderful glossy mound that the animal makes. Scientists think that is a defense mechanism to, you know, give the slip to a really strong crab claw. You can see a crab coming along and trying to grab that polished hump, and it just slips right out of its claw, right? And so many of the early flourishes are all about protection. For example, the bivalves, we know bivalves like oysters that attach themselves to the substrate in some way. That was to keep predators from plucking them off the floor of the sea. You've probably seen some clams in the sands that evolve these long siphons that poke up to draw their seawater and oxygen. That is to give them the ability to bury themselves and hide from predators, but still be able to breathe. Really early scallops were not able to swim, but because they needed to get out of the way of predators, they evolved to be able to swim. So many of the things we love about these animals and their shells, you know, the spikes, obviously the spikes and the spines and the fortress looking shell of a queen conch, it's all to keep the soft, vulnerable animal inside safe. And I love that about shells and what they are.
And I love their ability with secretions. I love their ability to make these fantastic colors, you know, like the variations of blue and purple.
Right. The colors, there are different reasons for the colors. Sometimes it's a result of what the animal eats, and sometimes it is a way to blend in with its surroundings. So yeah, the colors are fantastic, and the beautiful thing is that everything you love about shells, there's some really fascinating evolutionary reason behind it. And Mary, I want to say, while we're talking, because you are based in Tampa, one of my very favorite and best sources for this book, and a fellow who would be fantastic to have on the show sometime, maybe when summer is coming and people want to talk about seashells, is Gregory Herbert, who is a professor of paleobiology there at USF in Tampa. I visited his lab, and he taught me a lot about the evolution of these animals. That's his specialization, and he just knows so much. And the great thing about him is, just as he's working on their evolution and why things are the way they are, he's also working to protect these vulnerable animals with research into, you know, like our horse conchs and other important marine mollusks that live in the Gulf of Mexico. So I just want to give him a shout, because he has been, I relied on so many scientists to tell this story because it was a high learning curve for me. As you know, I previously specialized in water and climate, which I thought was pretty complex. But understanding the evolution of a 500 million year old animal was not easy either. And I really appreciate scientists like Greg who can just translate things in an understandable way. I feel envious of his students there at USF.
Well, the information in this book, this is not a single read book. I'm going to have to do this four or five times because, and it'll be enjoyable. No, I'm serious. Because there is so much science. There is so much history. And there is so much, you talk about the social structures of the communities because you can't talk about these organisms without talking about the impact of humans. Because not only have predators enjoyed eating each other, but we have really enjoyed eating our wares, and we have been a huge factor in their, being destroyed or practically destroyed in the efforts to bring them back, like the conch, I think it's fascinating, in the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. I don't think we'll have time to go into that now, but if people read the book, they'll get into that. But also, we have used shells throughout history, by we, I mean people, as money, as very valuable things. I mean, these are heirlooms. And I think just real quickly, I think we should do the story of shell oil because I really found that fascinating. They started out making these because women love these shells and they make, jewelry boxes.
Right,
and
right.
Yeah, so real,
yeah, Mary, it turns out I believe that is the reader's favorite story in the book. I get a lot of questions about shell oil and to tell the story briefly. Essentially, in the 1830s, there is a small Jewish curio shop owner named Marcus Samuel who is importing beautiful tropical
And so essentially they had the trade routes, and so the Samuel brothers realized that actually people have been getting oil from the sea and from the land all the time. I mean, this was, farmers did it, they did it all over the world, but it was just very small amounts. But then the Russians developed, and they had terrific oil. It was light, it burned well, and they also, at the same time, they were getting whales from the sea, oil for burning, well, that was a big deal. And so, anyway, they established these slave trade routes, and the Samuel brothers developed from the Murexel a type of boat that could go through the Suez Canal. And so then that made them able to get out of the Rothschilds' monopoly on the oil, and that kind of became the start, you might say, of America developing oil and becoming so huge in the oil industry, and that's just a very brief synopsis. And so, anyway, again, the book, and so I think we've reached the end, and so, Billy, we have a promo or what?
No, I think we're ready to just tell everybody. Hey there, Cynthia.
Thanks, Mary. I heard the whole story, and you did a great job. And I think it's just fascinating that Shell Oil one of the largest fossil fuel companies in America, started out as a small seashell curio shop on the east end of London. And you can imagine the reputation.
Cynthia, I hate to break in, but we have to break in. So thank